Okay, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Solari Report. Joining me is Whitney Webb, who needs no introduction here. So we have promoted many of her pieces, her websites, and we just think, Whitney, that you're doing outstanding work. And every time we think it can't get better, you pop out, you know, you're 10 out of a scale of 10, you pop out with two new ones that are just phenomenal. And I want to start off by you describing what you've written about the Wellcome Trust and what you've written about CyberPolygon.
Right. So the first article that's about the Wellcome Trust is about the Wellcome Trust's new endeavor called Wellcome Leap, which is essentially a team up between the Wellcome Trust and these individuals that previously were the leadership at the Pentagon's DARPA and then were taken from the military to the private sector, to Google and Facebook, to create their DARPA research equivalents, and have now gone on to do the same for Wellcome Leap, which is describes itself as a global health ARPA, essentially an organization modeled after DARPA, but focusing on global healthcare, or so they say. So a lot of people aren't familiar with the Wellcome Trust, and that's probably by design. A lot of the attention has been given to the Gates Foundation, but the Wellcome Trust is definitely on the same level in terms of influence over medical research, vaccine technology research, genetic engineering research, and a lot of these fields that are coming to the forefront relatively recently. They're much older, however, than the Gates Foundation. I believe they were created in the 30s. Out of the will of the pharmaceutical magnate Henry Wellcome, whose company Burroughs Wellcome is today known as GlaxoSmithKline. Right. He essentially set up through his will the Wellcome Trust to be an interconnected system of charity and for-profit foundations. So essentially it's a business model that masquerades as a charity. Right. And today it's the largest private medical research charity in the world, but it's based in the United Kingdom, so most of its influence is centered there, but of course it's a global.
Right. And one of the things you point out is a lot of what they're contemplating or the people they've spun out is very invasive kinds of healthcare applications.
Yeah. Well, I think they're justifying this technology that they've tried to develop under different guises in the past to justify it as healthcare in the wake of the COVID crisis. Right. So, you know, the head of this former director of DARPA that now leads Wellcome Leap, Regina Dugan, said COVID-19 is like what the launch of Sputnik was for the space age. COVID-19 is now the launch of the health age, she said, but this is health tech age. Because this woman, previously at running these DARPA equivalents at Google and Facebook, was developing brain machine interfaces, digital pills that turn your whole body into an authentication token, digital tattoos to unlock your devices, and all of this stuff. And none of that was justified under global healthcare. But now we've seen a lot of those same initiatives being justified as healthcare in recent years, particularly in the past year and a half. And if you look at the programs that Wellcome Leap is funding, it's quite clear that a lot of them have applications for control really of society as a whole, as opposed to really being about healthcare. So there's four programs, and the two most disturbing, I would argue, are actually relatively interconnected in the sense that they focus on the brains of people. One program specifically focuses on the brains of very young children and babies from 3 months of age to 3 years old, and the other one focusing on adults, supposedly under the guise of treating depression, but they openly state that they're hoping to develop wearables that, you know, for adults can track their motivation and energy levels, their sleep patterns, their emotional state, everything about them. And some of the wearables on the market, like Amazon's Halo, for example, already claim to be able to track your emotional state. Amazon just got an FCC license to track your sleep without your consent.
I know, I saw that. I wanted to ask you about that because I just saw the headline. I haven't had a chance to read the article, and I thought, oh, this is really bad.
Well, this shows you where it's going, right? So what Welcome Leap is developing, you know, these are people with deep ties to Silicon Valley. So Amazon is a part of this broader effort, but it's something, you know, Amazon, Google, Microsoft, all especially under COVID-19, have really poured a lot of research and effort and data into developing healthcare-based AI systems. And a lot of these are very invasive and involve monitoring not only what you are saying, what you're doing, what physical actions your body is taking, but also what's going on internally. And some of these two programs at Welcome Leap specifically want to be able to interrogate your brain state directly.
Well, think about this. You know, because the question always is, who is Amazon? The first time Amazon ever made a profit was when they got their $600 billion plus contract from the CIA.
Right.
And they now run the cloud for the 17 intelligence agencies.
They do. Mm-hmm.
And with that contract, you know, Bezos turned around and bought the Washington Post, because mm-hmm. you know, it's fantastic increase on the stock. And now, you know, the question is, will they get part of the JEDI contract at the DoD cloud? So when you talk about Amazon entering your dreams, is that Amazon or is that the CIA?
Yeah, we honestly can't know at this point. And a lot of a common theme in a lot of my work is a lot of these big Silicon Valley companies, right, the biggest ones. It's really impossible at this point to know where they begin and where the national security state begins, because they've essentially fused, whether that's between revolving doors in terms of hires or something like the National Security Commission on AI, which has set forth the entire AI policy of the national security state, but it was led by Eric Schmidt, the former CEO of Google,
right,
the current CEO of Amazon was on there, along with top people from the intelligence community and top people from the DoD. And so, you know, a lot of these same Silicon Valley companies are major, right, contractors to the intelligence community and also the military. So, you know, it's right, really hard to know. And at the same time, a lot of, you know, pretty much all of the COVID-19 data and also vaccination data in the US and also the UK is run by Palantir, which was essentially set up by the CIA and the neocons with the help, obviously, of Peter Thiel, fresh off of the sale of PayPal. So, you know, these are entities that have a longstanding connections more often than not to these same agencies. So Amazon wasn't necessarily set up by the CIA, but they got in bed with the US government,
right,
relatively early on. But in the case of companies like Google, for example, you know, that was set up with Inkytel funding,
right,
investigations have been done to their involvement and them becoming the monopoly they are today. Microsoft similarly has a lot of intelligence ties and also Jeffrey Epstein ties going back to the 1990s, among,
right,
other things that haven't been, you know, fully fleshed out by mainstream media. So a lot of this is quite concerning. So yeah, once you give this sort of power to Silicon Valley, it becomes quite problematic. And so who is going to hold that data? Well, these companies do on the same clouds that service the intelligence community,
right,
who are paying them vast amounts of money and have vast amounts of influence and are essential to, you know, their maintenance of this kind of power they hold over society. So if they ask for that access, I mean, they'll get it. And we have precedents of that, you know, taking place after 9/11 with the NSA,
right,
and intelligence agencies asking Microsoft, asking Hewlett Packard, and a lot of prominent tech companies for access to consumer consumer devices and people's internet traffic and,
right,
and information and things like that. And they gave it willingly to them without disclosing that to the people using their products. So, you know, this is really a slippery slope, and it's not being talked about, which is really unfortunate. But what I find so insane about Welcome Leap is that the hubris of the program, in the sense that they're openly willing to talk about doing this to children, developing an AI model of the perfect child's brain, and then going back within 10 years and having, if their goals are accomplished, 80% of children's brains being essentially pruned or manipulated to fit that model,
right,
which has huge implications for future generations and the future of human creativity, imagination. It's really a way to homogenize, you know, the human intellect in our youngest members. And it's amazing that they were willing to put this out publicly and admit this on paper. This seems to me like it's something that a black budget that would be a black budget intelligence program, to be honest, and they're doing it out in the open.
Right.
And to me, that suggests that they're just so emboldened by a lot of things that have happened in the past year and a half, specifically with COVID-19 vaccination trials being done on infants, young children, right. Things like that, that, well, you know, parents are offering their kids up for that, so why wouldn't they do it for this and whatnot? But it's very egregious if you actually bother to think through the implications and read the program description.
Well, I think one of the great things about your article is that much of the material that they publish, most people aren't going to read, but that's what you're doing. You're connecting, you know, you're connecting their flagrancy to the, you know, to the people and connecting the dots. So let's talk about CyberPolygon, because these are two aspects of what my nickname for all of this used to be, the data beast.
That's fair.
Right. Because Americans think that there are 24 different government agencies at the U.S. federal government. There's not. There's one data beast. It all ends up getting sucked into the, you know, into a very small numbers of really database operations. So tell us about CyberPolygon. What was that about?
So CyberPolygon is the second exercise hosted by the World Economic Forum in coordination with a state-owned Bank of Russia, Sberbank, one of the largest financial institutions in Russia, and also with the participation of the Prime Minister of Russia as well. This year's theme was a little different than last year's. It was more focused on supply chain, simulating a supply chain attack. Of course, we've seen a lot of those in the news with SolarWinds. Right. And more recently, I believe the company is Kaisa, that was hacked, that, you know, was similar in scope to SolarWinds. So that was the specific simulation they were conducting. But CyberPolygon has two parts. So they have this technical training simulation aspect, and then they have expert panels of international experts. And most of those international experts happen to be part of something called the World Economic Forum Partnership Against Cybercrime that we can talk about in a second. But essentially, the themes there are about creating new global digital ecosystems that are heavily centralized, ending anonymity online as a way to combat cybercrime, ending financial anonymity specifically as a way to combat ransomware, and things of that nature. And so, you know, it's obviously them laying out a roadmap for control of the online world at the time when they openly admit that COVID-19 has forced much of the world into the digital sphere. So, you know, them basically using that as a trap to take more control than they've ever been able to take before. Them, in this case, being the globalists, the World Economic Forum, the public-private partnerships, whatever you want, however you want to look at that, that's essentially what CyberPolygon is simulating and discussing. And so a lot of those things are solutions that we will be offered in the event of the next big hack that takes lots of things offline, directly impacts the lives of numerous people around the world, and has people demanding solutions in a way sort of like 9/11, for example, manufactures consent and has a lot of those demands appear from the American public for, you know, things like a new homeland security apparatus that was introduced into Congress months before, in like March or May of 2001. At the time, people were like, we don't need a new agency for that. And then after 9/11, it's anything to beat the terrorists. So too,
right.
This cyber pandemic, as Klaus Schwab has predicted, does manifest the ideas that people will demand an end to ransomware forever. And this longstanding agenda, specifically in the US and the EU and the UK, of having government issued IDs be necessary for internet access, the driver's license for the internet, as it was called under the Obama administration. This is essentially where this is going, but it also has a focus on financial transactions.
Right.
And that's why the focus of ransomware in the context of these cyber attacks and the cyber pandemic, and, you know, it's very prominent in CyberPolygon for a very specific reason. They want to be able to track people's finances.
So it's very interesting, because the more they try and persuade you that the digital world is lacking in integrity, the more they try and centralize everything into the digital world. The multiple personality disorder of their marketing is quite extraordinary.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. Well, I also think it's quite astounding when you consider that these entities at the WEF that host Cyber Polygon, the U.S. Department of Justice, the FBI, and the Secret Service are all part of that. But at the same time, it's being, you know, co-hosted essentially by a Russian government state-owned entity. When all this talk of Russian hackers, we have to implement all of these policies in the U.S. to control what you do online and all of that because of the Russian government, but they're fine to participate in this simulation of hacks and things like that with the Russian government when they could, you know, in theory, if this was really the problem, wouldn't they raise concerns about, well, the Russians could gather intelligence about how we would respond to cyber attacks and all of that stuff and use it against us. None of those discussions are there. No concerns are raised. And it tells you, in my opinion, that a lot of these entities are fine to work together behind the scenes, right, to build out this infrastructure for this digital panopticon, essentially, and are just using the same nation state conflicts that have been used for decades and decades, because they're familiar to people as justification for implementing them in their respective countries. But all of these countries at the end of the day are very interested in controlling their domestic populations much more than anything else, and more often than not seem to be working towards that. And if it means collaborating behind the scenes, that seems to be how it happens.
I have to tell you a silly story. I won't go into the whole detail. In 2005, someone from Russia tried to recruit me. They basically said, look, you'll always be a target. You'll never be appreciated in your country. You know, and they offered me a chance to sort of come over to the other team. And it was, I was in the middle of the last year of my litigation with the Department of Justice. And it was, the whole thing, Whitney, was so bizarre, so odd. I got home and I said, you know, and basically what I said is, nobody likes a traitor. I'm not interested. You know, I'm going to, and you know, I stay with the dance partner I came with. So I went home and I said, something's really wrong. I'm missing something. And I got online and realized, oh, Russia and the Russian funds were the number two holders of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac's in the world. And they were just helping the mortgage guys get me out of town. It was, no, I mean, it was amazing, yeah, because you realize things are never, you know, they're never as they
No, I think that's very true. And like the oligarchy in Russia, you know, the involvement of people like Larry Summers and that whole crowd after the collapse of the Soviet Union and setting up the way Russia's economy functions. There's a lot of involvement or connections between the Russian oligarchs and Israel, a close U.S. ally, right, which collaborates with U.S. financial system a lot, obviously. I mean, there's a lot of interconnectedness behind the scenes that doesn't really get talked about. And I think there's a lot of effort to keep us focused on this sort of superficial narrative of the,
right,
of the power play. It's Russia and China versus the US and the West and all of this stuff in order to prevent us from seeing what's going on behind the scenes. But if you look at groups like the World Economic Forum and some of these other, organizations like them, and they're all meeting together.
Happy days yeah, are here again. So, yeah. So did you get a copy of our Going Direct Reset?
Yes, I have
it. Oh, fantastic. Okay, fantastic. So have you had a chance to take a look?
Yeah, so I read the Going Direct Reset article, and I found it really illuminating in terms of the role of BlackRock, if you don't mind me asking about it for my listeners.
Let's go ahead. And I should just mention BlackRock was involved in the litigation, so I have some personal experience with BlackRock, which fits the narrative.
Oh, well, I'm sure that must have been fun, given their reputation. So I was wondering if you could explain a little bit, well, in detail for people that aren't experts on this type of stuff, or even necessarily experts on Federal Reserve policy, how the Federal Reserve's response to COVID-19 preceded the declaration of COVID-19 as a pandemic by several months, and how the plan the Federal Reserve implemented was essentially set up by BlackRock, and what that plan entailed and what its implications have been.
So in August 22nd, 2019, the G7 central bankers who meet every year in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, voted on a plan called the Going Direct Reset. And that plan was designed by a group of retired central bankers who had literally parked and worked through the BlackRock Investment Institute, which is sort of an arm that BlackRock does to engage in policy discussion. And that plan was voted on by the central bankers, who proceeded after the, you know, everybody goes back to the office. And sure enough, in September, the Fed rolls into the repo market and starts engaging in what is extraordinary intervention in the markets, including doing something that has never happened before, which is directly injecting money into the economy, not just into the reserve. Normally, they inject money into the reserve system, and then the reserve system will or will not inject money into the economy. This time, they injected direct. What was interesting is that BlackRock at the time published some of the material describing the plan. And if you look at what they are doing, which I would describe as sort of a consolidation of what I have called the financial coup d'etat, the actions taken through the healthcare legal and regulatory system that started in March 2020 were simply part of the going direct reset. And what you watched was an injection of significant money into, I would oversimplify as Wall Street, at the same time the healthcare rules shut down the Main Street economy. And so you have a shutdown. The little guys are basically shut down by disaster capitalism working through the healthcare system, whereas the big money players get massive amounts of money to go out and engage in global sweepstake, which is buy everything cheap. One of the reasons they can do this is BlackRock is an asset manager who manages, it's one of the largest holders of index funds and retirement savings. And so a lot of the money they're swinging around are individual money or working through pension funds, but that have major positions in every company in America. So if you look at the pharmaceuticals, if you look at all the companies, all the tech companies, you know, BlackRock again and again and again has a big position. So while they're managing all these companies, then the Fed does something absolutely unprecedented. In my world as a financial person, I cannot tell you how shocking it was. They basically turned over operational asset management functions for the Fed and the New York Fed to BlackRock. They just simply delegated. This is the equivalent of, imagine if the Department of Justice called you up and said, Whitney, we want you to start a company and we're going to turn over different aspects of enforcement for the United States to your company. I mean, it was an extraordinary and very shocking thing. In the meantime, Larry Fink, who's the head of BlackRock, is basically running around the financial world pontificating about social responsibility. So here we have here we have BlackRock in the room to engineer the greatest example of disaster capitalism and economic warfare ever engineered in the history of the world, that literally at first blush put 500 million people out of work while he's pontificating to people about social responsibility. It was quite extraordinary. And you wonder, you know, you know, hubris is one thing. This was so over the top. It was, you know, George Orwell would have just, it would have shocked Orwell. It was quite extraordinary.
I think Fink's purpose there, well, let's keep in mind too, that he's on the board of trustees of the World Economic Forum. So very, very involved with their stakeholder capitalism evangelism efforts, I guess you could say. So him going around talking about social responsibility and we need to be more inclusive and all of this uses essentially the same buzzwords that the World Economic Forum uses, or groups like the Council for Inclusive Capitalism. And of course, that council, which is headed by the Pope, supposedly, includes several other members of the WEF Board of Trustees, like Mark Carney, the central former Bank of England governor. Also, Mark Benioff, who's on the WEF as well, and is the founder of Salesforce and the head of their Fourth Industrial Revolution Committee.
Let me just give you an example of social responsibility. When the central bankers, so Jay Powell, Mark Carney at that time was in the room for the Bank of England, when they walked in that room and voted to do going direct, they literally knew they were going to put 500 million people out of work. Okay. And so that is the equivalent of dropping several nuclear bombs on major cities around the world. You just do it, you know, it's a financial nuclear bomb instead of a physical nuclear bomb, but it's going to kill hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people. And you know that voting on it. So right. when Mark Carney talks about social responsibility, he's talking about social responsibility, having intentionally and knowingly made a decision. You know, there's a German expression for it. It's called desk killer. You know, has made a decision essentially to drop the equivalent of a nuclear bomb. And so the comparison between what they're doing and what they're saying is quite extraordinary and communicates a level of disrespect for the average person that says what it says.
Yeah, I think that's pretty significant, but I think that's also common in this whole mindset that they view themselves as sort of stewards for the future of human society and the human race, but have complete contempt for everyone on the that's not in the elite circles in which they operate, essentially, and think they know what's you know, it's the whole technocrat mindset.
Right. Well, Mark Carney just published a book called Values, which I'm reading. And
that must
so
be fun.
I'm looking forward to aligning his values with what he's done so far.
Yeah, well, that will be telling. But I think one thing that I learned recently about Mark Carney that fits sort of into the context of some of these things we've been talking about is that in 2019, he gave a speech about how a new economic system was going to be needed in order to move the U.S., the world to a net zero economy, basically a change, remake the economy under the guise of climate change, that a whole new economic system was going to be ushered in. So it's interesting right. then to see people connected to him through the WEF, like Larry Fink, for example, sort of orchestrating this, what you described as like this nuclear bomb in terms of right. the fiscal response to COVID-19, essentially weakening even further an already weakened financial and economic system in the United States, perhaps with the purpose of putting something new in its place.
Well, remember, they have two issues. They have, if you look at what I call the financial coup, they have levered up the national governments and then shifted the money out of those governments or out of those pension funds. So think of this as a bank robbery. And before everybody, you know, sort of realizes the money's gone and they want the money back, they need essentially a ruse to reconsolidate the system. And one of the things they need is total financial control. Mm-hmm. And that requires an electrical grid. If they're going to do CBDCs and have the kind of tech and data intensive grid that you're talking about with your last two articles, they need everybody on an electrical system. If I have you in an electric car and you are doing all your transactions digitally, then I can control where you can travel to and I can turn off your money anywhere, anytime, anyplace. Mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah, that's the goal of, I think, central bank digital currencies is to do that. And they've been quite explicit about total control being the goal of that, about as explicit as you can be. But it's becoming more apparent to me, and that's why I found this Carney speech so revealing from 2019, is that over the course of this year, we've seen sort of the climate change issue pop up again. And we had right. Klaus Schwab in the beginning of January essentially announced before the virtual Davos conference of this year that the fear and concern over COVID-19 by the end of 2021 was going to give way to climate change. That there right. would be that same sort of fear that enveloped the world during most of 2020, but with climate change. And obviously that fear and that crisis, however it manifests, and that these people apparently have advanced knowledge of, will be used for some purpose. And it seems to be a creation of a new financial system, because not long after Klaus Schwab said that, Larry Fink of BlackRock gave made some interesting statements in his annual letter that came out not that long afterwards. And it's quoted in the New York Times. Well, the New York Times describes what Larry Fink was doing as, it says, Fink is pushing out the goalpost on climate action, asking companies to, quote, disclose a plan for how their business model will be compatible with a net zero economy. With nearly $9 trillion of investments, BlackRock has a lot of influence. Last year, the firm voted against 69 companies and against 64 directors for climate-related reasons, and put 191 companies on watch. Right. So he's definitely moved that way. And we've seen since then Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan, Vanguard, and a lot of others, titans of finance, sort of pivot their focus on ESGs, these environmental social governance, rules for corporations. And because of BlackRock's influence and stakes in so many corporations, it seems like they are basically planning to do sort of a corporate coup under the guise of climate change and institute a lot of these moves that are going to take us towards stakeholder capitalism, as the WEF likes
to call. So what they're trying to do is use social responsibility to assert capital control centrally.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you look at how these things are going to be applied, it's going to be very arbitrary. So, you know, think of the official story, and then there's the real story. And the real story is central capital controls and back to the financial control. The thing to understand, and I have yet to see how they're going to roll this out, you want climate change because COVID exhaustion is upon us. So you need a new ruse. Mm-hmm. That's part of it. But the other part of it is the climate change regulations they proposed in the past, and I think they're going to try again, are very effective at moving people off the land and grabbing assets.
Right.
So if you want to backdoor seize a huge amount of assets and get control of the land, climate change is a very effective way. So it gets you your smart grid, but it also gets you major access at low price to a lot of land and real estate.
Right. I think that's fair too. And I think they definitely want to do that because they want to herd people towards the smart cities and all that stuff as they
right.
get that set up and prevent really any sort of existence in rural areas, and that climate change will be the justification for that. But I also think, if this does come to pass in the U.S., obviously it's going to put a lot of energy behind the so-called Green New Deal and things like this. And if you read it, or at least the version as it was going around when I wrote on it back in 2018, when Ocasio-Cortez was first promoting it, they like to talk about it in very flowery language, but if you actually read it, it's essentially a promotion of cap and trade and would be funded by the Fed and all of this
right.
stuff, really as far away as you can get from any sort of progressive policy. And do you want to comment?
Well, here's what's happening, and the new Green Deal is definitely part of it. You know, we've had a balance of power between the electorate voting for the people who control the budget and fiscal policy and the bankers controlling monetary policy through the central bank. What this is, and what BlackRock is at the heart of doing, is engineering a complete takeover of the treasury function by the central banks. In other words, you know, the basically electorate is getting pushed out. And that's why the issue is going to come down to taxation without representation.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the reasons it's so important to have a ruse of some kind, like climate change, is as people get concerned about why should we pay taxes for something that's destroying us, destroying our businesses, you know, they need an excuse. Oh, it's an emergency. It's a climate emergency. Which, of course, my favorite part of the Biden administration was appointing a climate czar who flies around in his own private plane.
I mean, all of these people, more often than not, tend to fly
right.
around in their private planes. You
right.
know, like Bill Gates, when Klaus Schwab announced this imminent pivot to climate change, did that pivot and is now talking about climate change and doing book tours and all of this before the Epstein
right.
stuff sort of flared its head again.
Right.
And he was doing that in private jets. And that's, you know, it's another example of what we saw with, you know, COVID-19, that there's rules for the little people, but not for the elite. And they claim that we're all in this together. And that's the selling point of climate change as well. But it's going to be rules that the elite don't have to follow, or even certain institutions that they need to enforce this system they want to create, like the military, for example. So like the U.S. military, one of the most polluting organizations on earth.
Right.
If you want to talk about, you know, the official climate change narrative, you should be outraged they're not included in the Green New Deal at all, because they're
right.
the largest consumer of fossil fuels. And there's
right.
no mention of that at all. But they need the military to enforce this system, whether domestically, because Biden back in 1995 tried to get Posse Comitatus removed. Some people forget about that. It's very likely
right.
he'll do it again under the guise of domestic terrorism or whatever. So, you know, it really, it's going to be, you know, rules for thee, but not for me all over again.
One of my favorite descriptions was I had a scientist once entertain me for a lunch comparing the carbon use of Lockheed F-35s to cows. It was pretty funny. So obviously these guys, you know, this is really about grabbing resources and resource control centrally. And this is part of building the smart grid. There was one thing I wanted to mention to you. Did you ever go look at the website for inclusive capitalism?
The Council on Inclusive Capitalism, yes. Yeah. And the people that are there. So Microsoft, MasterCard, Visa, and Ernst & Young, and the Rockefeller Foundation.
I went into the website to try and understand what they were proposing. Mm-hmm. And to sign in, you had to click the terms and conditions. And the terms and conditions was not a normal terms and condition. It read, you had to pledge allegiance. You had to agree with their values.
Wow.
And so I wouldn't click it. So I never went into the website. I never saw it. But it was quite sort of, you know, it's like a cult. Is what it read like.
Yeah, a little bit. Well, they already have that sort of religious flavor to it, don't they, with having teamed up with the Vatican to sell this.
Okay, so here's, I want to get back to one part of your work, which I think is very important. One of the little secrets of the hypocrisy of rules for them and rules for us is it is unbelievably expensive to make them look efficient or economic. If you look at how much money is being stolen and laundered and channeled to pump them up, mm-hmm. I mean, they are part of an economy that I call, it has a negative return on investment, and it requires massive amounts of money to pump them up. And you are in the middle of writing a book about one of the great pump up operations of all time, right?
Yeah, if you're referring to Jeffrey Epstein, yes. But it's a book that's also more than just Epstein. So it's going back to really one of the underlying main components, really, of the underlying power structure in the United States, which is the fact that the National Crime Syndicate, the organized crime union, essentially, that dominated organized crime in the U.S. for a very long time, this marriage of the Jewish mob and the Italian mafia got in bed with intelligence agencies. And that alliance never ended. And so that's essentially what gave rise to Epstein and a lot of other people in that network, and how this continues to operate. So it will be controversial probably when it comes out, but
it's it's absolutely an unbelievably important story, because if you look at how organized crime and the different syndicates have evolved and become part of the deep state and literally taken control, we're dealing with a criminal model. And I think it's hard to understand it until you see the history, and you've done a very good job of unpacking the history. And I think this is right at the heart of the issue. So I think this is going to be a very important book, and I can't wait. So I know you're feeling the pressure. I don't want to put more pressure.
No, it's fine. Well, I definitely agree that it needs to be written, you know.
Right.
The pressure I feel is that there's so much going on in the world constantly happening that isn't being, you know, there's so many stories that aren't being covered, because unfortunately there's still tons of people in independent media totally asleep at the wheel about a lot of stuff that's going on, which is really unfortunate. So, you know, that puts more burden on people like you and me and the other people that are, I have the integrity to actually report about a lot of the stuff that has been happening, despite the censorship risks or the other risks that come with it. That sort of adds to the burden a little bit, but I just, you know, the story is so important and so central to all the other current stuff happening right now. I think being able to lay out the evolution of that alliance over the decades will be illuminating. And since, you know, Epstein is sort of this, a lot of people still are very interested in the case, despite his arrest, you know, 2 years ago. And I think that's very much very disappointing to the powers that be, hoping that people would have moved on already. but he still, you know, his story still commands a lot of interest. So I think it's an effective way to get the message across that essentially the powers that be are the mob, but state protected and using state funds to right. accomplish the crimes and the rackets that they have been involved with for a very long time.
Have you ever looked into the Forrestal assassination? Because I believe it was a fusion of those.
I'm familiar with that. So that would be the Secretary of Defense who was assassinated right before the CIA got
the 49. My theory is, you know, one part of the mob wanted Israel because they wanted a sovereign government to work with.
They got that though too.
So the Rockefeller Syndicate wanted the CIA Act. So they'd gotten the 47 Act, but they wanted the 49 Act and they wanted Israel. So they made a deal and part, you know, to get that done, you had to get rid of Forrestal. So anyway, okay. So let's turn to what we can do. I was meeting in Switzerland with the European Children's Health Defense a couple weeks ago. And we were talking about how the vaccine passports were going to be used as part of this control network that you and I have been discussing. What could we do about it? And I said, you know, we have to, you know, the one of the reasons they did what they did with the pandemic is to try and get the cash usage down, down, down. And we've got to reverse that. And so Mary Holland, who's the wonderful president of Children's Health Defense, said, well, what about Cash Friday? Let's do Cash Friday. And for some reason, it just, you know, we all loved it because we all know about, you know, eating fish on Friday or getting dressed down to go to the office on Friday. You know, people do special things on Friday. And it's hard to try and go to all cash, but you can do one day. So we said, okay, let's launch Cash Friday. And so we just put up a thing, and the some of the activists around the World Freedom Alliance are going to launch it in August. So it's hopefully percolating and will spread. But I put up a little video of Carstens, the head of the Bank of International Settlements, basically explaining in 56 seconds why they're going to have complete control of all your money. And it's really funny because when you show that to people, they realize, oh,
that's, you know, bad.
You know, yeah. maybe digital money is so convenient and can be so much fun, but maybe I don't want 100% digital, you know?
Right.
So you've taken a look at Cash Friday. What do you think?
Well, I think it's a great idea because what I mentioned earlier when we were talking about my latest piece about the end of anonymity is that they're going to go, you know, that way by two different ways. So they want to go after, you know, decentralized digital cash that they feel like they can't control as easily, or that would, you know, compete in terms of interest in their digital currencies. They don't want competitors that would be more appealing. They want to force adoption of theirs, right?
Right.
But also cash. And so what we saw with the Chinese, for example, piloting and implementing the digital yuan earlier this year is that they also cracked down on Bitcoin and mining and all of this stuff, but they also talked about cash for the same reason, saying criminals could use it. And this is the argument that's been made for a long time. Early on with COVID-19, the World Health Organization said, don't use cash because it can have germs on it, and stay away from anything physical. You're safe with the screen. And all of this stuff, which is, you know, I don't really think that was a medical opinion. I think that was something else guiding that opinion. But obviously, anything we can do to hedge against these efforts to end anonymous transactions is in our benefit. And I think a lot of people are relying really heavily on the digital side of that. But I think cash is really attractive for a lot of different reasons, in the sense that you're also sort of, not only are you taking a stand against this effort to eliminate the ability to have anonymous financial transactions, but you're also taking a stand against this effort to herd us into a 100% digital world. So I think, you know, that is appealing. And as you said, a lot of people don't want to do it every day. So picking one day a week is simple enough that I think a lot of people could adopt it. But of course, getting people to do something new, you know, sometimes it can be difficult, but hopefully people, you know, listening to this are aware enough of what's going on in the world that, you know, we need to start making some changes to our lives in order to be more prepared and in order to resist this in a way that doesn't necessarily involve us, you know, going head to head with police officers and stuff like that. Like, there are ways to protest and resists that are more passive but also still effective. And I would argue that the most effective way would be counter economics, and that looks a lot of different ways that can look depending on your community and how interested they are in counter economics. And I think with the vaccine passport scheme advancing, we will see more interest in that across the world at the community level, and hopefully more efforts to implement counter-economic systems emerge. But I think in terms of something that's like globally uniting, this is a very, a creative and effective way to go.
Yeah, so this, you can do this in every town and village and country around the world, pretty much. You can also, we've just published something we had before, and it got destroyed, and we've just built it back. It's called the Silver and Gold Payment Calculator. And it will allow you to, it basically translates between, we're doing a new feed and then it's going to be 150 currencies and gold and silver. So you can use your gold and silver and local coins to just pay everything if you want. And it's a way to start a community currency on the just do it basis. So you just agree you're going to do it and you do it. You don't have to start an organization, make a plan, anything else. You just do it. The thing I'm hoping is that the small businesses and the small credit unions and community banks will realize they have a vested interest in keeping cash going.
Yeah, because otherwise it'll just be the big banks and the central banks at the end of the day, and they won't even be around anymore.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. So they're beginning to realize, CBDC, universal basic income, is going to wipe out our business. Right. So I don't know. I think I'm hopeful that I'm a great believer in baby steps. We start to do baby steps and then we can start to make the connections. Because you're right, I think everybody can do it on Friday. I don't know if you saw my receipt. We were driving back from the meeting and we stopped to get dinner and we said, okay, it was Friday. And so we did. We paid cash. Okay, so tell us what's next for Whitney.
Well, really quick, I did have some readers that knew I was going to be speaking with you that wanted your advice on how, given these things that are going on in the world, how what steps they could take to preserve their wealth, given this plan for a great reset of the financial system, because there's a lot of people that are concerned out there that don't really know what to do and thought you may have some answers.
So the most important, let's talk about what's really important. The most important thing is to have resilience. So by resilience, what I mean is, you know, the power shuts down for 3 weeks and you can handle it. The price of food goes up 30% in a year and you can handle it. And the way you can handle it is by doing more for yourself, either individually or collectively within your community. Okay. So the more you can build local fresh food systems, the more you can, you know, build a well. I used to have a client who would always complain to me that the yields on her stock portfolio were going down, and she was in a place where she could build a well. I said, it's real simple. Sell your stocks and build a well. Because we've been intermediated by the corporations, and we can disintermediate them. But it means we have to do more for ourselves, more locally, more with other people. And that's what builds in the huge resilience. So I was pretty sure that the financial coup would lead to significant inflation, and it's one of the reasons I moved my home base in the United States to one of the lowest cost areas. So, you know, and so I've had much less inflation over the last 10 years than if I lived in the high inflation areas, but I'm also in a place where people know tremendous amounts of about how to do everything for ourselves. You know, and that's that's the ethic. The second thing I would say is, if you have kids, with rare exception, you're going to have to homeschool or start a school. Unfortunately, everybody's paying real estate taxes to a jurisdiction, and that jurisdiction is using that money in a way that, in the best case, is just not getting your child the kind of education you need. So the most important investment most families make is raising their children. And so I would really rethink how you raise your child and how your children get educated, because that's going to have a very, very important swing. Healthcare, believe it or not, the greatest source, in my experience, of destruction of family wealth is chronic disease and things like vaccine injury. And so it is worth it to spend the time and money to get off the the healthcare treadmill. And it is very, very important to spend as much as you can for the highest quality fresh food. So if you can build really fresh food, so all of these things that I'm talking about now, Whitney, are about building your living equity, not your financial equity. Mm-hmm. Because if you don't do that, there's not enough financial equity in the world that can make up for the drain you're going to get on your living equity.
Right, right.
Okay. So that's the number one. Number two, jurisdiction matters. The reason you are where you are was because you were in a jurisdiction that was no longer compatible with the way you were going to live, right?
Yeah.
Right.
So
okay.
I can explain why a little bit. So, you know, some of the stuff you talked about, like people knowing how to do stuff for themselves and being able to grow their own food. That's why I found where I was living in Chile very attractive. Right. I did not count on them going even farther than places like New Zealand and Ontario with COVID-19 so quickly. Chile already has UBI. They already have a domestic vaccine passport
right.
that you need to go to the bank to get gas, to go into the supermarket.
Wow.
And all of this stuff. And it got zero media coverage. It's almost like no one is really paid attention to Chile, you know, now that it's been launched in France or proposed in France, you know, there's protests and
right.
stuff. Chile had no protests, not a blip.
Wow.
Mass acceptance. Because
why?
Well, I would argue a couple things. One, cultural conditioning from the Pinochet era. People are
right.
just like, leave me alone as long, you know, a lot of people are very invested in maintaining the status quo, preventing instability, and all of that stuff. And just because of Operation Condor and a lot of things that happen, people just tend to acquiesce to power. And also there's a lot of trust in the health institutions,
right.
which are seen as different than the government. And even though, you know, the government was hugely unpopular, that was sort of reversed by this, we're in this together, it's a war effort type of approach to COVID-19 and the complete control of the media. Most Chileans get their news from the television, which is state TV or CNN
right.
and things like that. So it was just very complete, you know, and a lot of people not really willing to question what was going on there. But yeah, it's very unfortunate. Like even my kid's babysitter in Chile, who we absolutely loved and was like a second mom to my kid, basically was like, oh, the vaccine passport's going to bring relief and it's going to make things easier. And I was just like, how do I even start to explain this to you? And she's like a very well-meaning person and stuff, but it's because it's you know, because of the TV. So, you know,
right.
Chile, you know, I didn't expect that. Some of the things you were talking about, like resiliency and stuff, I saw problems with that in the US, you know, because I'm 31
right.
and my generation in the US, like very few people know how to do anything for themselves in terms of producing their own food or things they
right.
need in their everyday life. And in Latin America, it's a very different approach, but yeah, a lot of this I didn't anticipate. So now I'm in the UK because, you know, I didn't really have many options for residency beyond, you know, Chile where I had residency. So it was either the US or the UK. The UK was just easier for me because of personal circumstances,
right.
but in,
right.
compared to Chile, you know, there's a lot more local resistance here than there was in Chile. So the
right.
acquiescence in Chile was obviously the most disconcerting to me for multiple reasons. And the fact that they wanted my 3-year-old to wear a mask outside all the time. And there was no daycare. I couldn't even get childcare. You know, if they declare quarantine, you're only allowed out of your house for 4 hours a week, twice a week, 2 hours each. And you have to show police papers to prove that you're allowed to be out of your home. I mean, it's just it's insane. It's just as it's beyond the Pinochet era. Like Pinochet, I don't think
right.
would have even imagined having that kind of
right.
power back when he was in charge. So it's just astounding.
Well, he didn't have digital technology.
Well, they had some, like Operation Condor relied
right.
on databases and things like that and
right.
and whatnot and tracking technology. But of that era, you know, the advances in technology have allowed a lot of this to advance to levels they never previously perhaps thought possible. So, you know, the reason I'm in the UK now is because of a lot of stuff that you have mentioned,
right.
You know, resilience and stuff and stuff like that. But, you know, for different reasons.
Right. Mm-hmm. So jurisdiction matters. If you're not in a good jurisdiction and you have the ability to get to a better jurisdiction, particularly if you can get to a better jurisdiction with like-minded people. Okay. Cause
yes.
I'm talking about all the things that significantly reduce your risk. Okay, from then on, particularly for your generation, the most important thing is to invest in your skills, okay? Your skills are things you can take with you anywhere. They can't seize them. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So for example, I would say you're investing to take the time to write the book on Epstein. It's a great investment. It's an investment in you and your, well, I just read, have you ever heard of a book called Furious Hours?
No.
By Casey Sepp? Okay, it's a story. Apparently, after she had helped Truman Capote write In Cold Blood, Harper Lee, the author of To Kill a Mockingbird, covered a trial in Alabama, which she was going to write a book. She wrote a huge amount, but never published a book. Mm-hmm. And it's the story of the trial and what she did and why. And it has a lot of biographical information about Harper Lee. Now, get this. Harper Lee was working as a travel agent in New York. I think it was 1956. And some friends of hers had a very good year in business. And for Christmas, gave her enough money so she could quit her job as a travel agent and just write for a year. And that's the year she wrote To Kill a Mockingbird, which has now sold 40 million.
Wow.
40 million copies and made her many times over a multiple, you know, multimillionaire. Can you imagine if instead they had put their money in the stock market instead of investing in Harper Lee? Right. So right. I'm very big on people investment. And I'll give you an example that I often use. When my litigation started and the Department of Justice tried to shut me off from all my revenues, all my assets, all my credit, et cetera, it turned out I had loaned or given $250,000 to friends and families. And they all sort of got together and said, well, I guess she needs it back. And over the next 11 years, I was gifted or loans were returned in an amount of $250,000, almost exactly to the dollar. And if it hadn't been for that money, Whitney, I would never have made it. Never. So, and part of the things that helped me, I had a very successful uncle who said, well, you know, she's helped everybody, so I'll help her. And as you know, one of the goals in those kind of situations, they try and isolate people. They couldn't isolate me because I had invested in other people, and those people or other people invested back. And so, you know, I recommend people investing very much to you because, you know, the question, Andrew Vax is one of my favorite sort of detective novel writers, says your family are the people who won't turn you in. And building those kind of networks is really, really important. And so I would build your skills. I would build your own business a la writing the Epstein book. I would invest in other people, including helping them start their businesses. If you have a local farmer or somebody doing fresh food, you know, that's exactly the kind of person you want to invest in now, you know, not only because you have a food supply, but if things go south, you know, if you have those relationships, they're the people to count on. Beyond that, if you're going to invest in financial assets, you know, I invest in financial assets. So I invest in coins, I invest in the stock market. But I like to invest in things that are real and productive. So for example, my investment advisory company does a screen, and my job is to just, you know, my definition of the screen is screening out criminality. So, you know, if you're a criminal, you don't get on the screen. And what's nice about doing the screen is I study companies all over the world, and there are hundreds of thousands of entrepreneurs and business people who are building and doing great companies, but we never hear about them. I never hear about them. I'm too busy looking at the fraudsters. So
yeah, I know how that
right,
can be.
Right. So, but you know, that is going on, and it's going on in every county and every community in the world. So, you know, whether it's privately in your own business or in your local community where you're doing private investment in businesses in the local area, your friends, helping your friends start business, you know, or buying companies in the stock market that are totally legitimate. I'm a great believer in if we're going to live in a world we want to live in, we've got to build that world. And you build that world one transaction, one company, one product at a time. And so find the people and the companies and products that have real integrity. And that's if you have enough money beyond your own infrastructure, beyond having a reserve in the bank and having You know me, I always say always have enough gold to bribe the border guards. So I like having gold and silver for the worst case. So, but it's a balance because there's no magic bullet. And one of the reasons there's no magic bullet in a world of tyranny, which is where they want to go, they're gonna take all your assets. So if there's no law, you know, everything's worthless.
Right. Well, sort of how I looked at it, and I'm not like a financial person like you. I just like, you know, think practically. And so like I have sort of thought like that for a long time. So actually like really early on, I like, you know, I in school, like double majored. And one of the things I majored in was agroecology. I learned how to grow my own food and like managed a farm for a year before doing any sort of writing stuff. and stuff like that. But, you know, given how things are going now, the way I think about the preserving wealth question is like, well, if all my money in the bank were to be inaccessible or disappear tomorrow, what would I have wished I had bought in order to, you know, be all right for a difficult period of a month, 3 months, whatever. And so I sort of think in sort of those terms.
So anything you can do to inventory or stockpile non-perishables is the best investment in the world. One, because of inflation. But the other thing is, you know, it's not sitting in the bank. It's sitting in your, one of my closets in Hickory Valley, I have two cases of tiny liquor bottles. Because what you'll find is when you get a real economic implosion, one of the most valuable currency. Well, Dmitry Orlov will tell you that vodka was worth more than, was a better currency than gold during the collapse of Russia. But given the inflationary environment we're in, any real asset you can stockpile, if you've got the room and the wherewithal to do it, absolutely.
One thing I will add to this discussion too is that from what I know from people, I know when I was living in South America for a very long time, so I knew a lot of people from Argentina who lived through the 2001 economic collapse, and I heard from several people that the best thing they did was mentally prepare for that scenario, even if they weren't necessarily the most physically prepared, they were mentally prepared to not give into the panic when it all happened, to be able to think rationally about what to do, to not have their mood and energy just totally sucked out of them. And in this desperate situation, the stronger you can be mentally in a crisis by knowing what's coming and all of that stuff, I think is a pretty decent way to prepare as well.
Right. And one of the things I would prepare, and many people in the United States have not prepared for this, is dealing with lawlessness. So, because you're talking about highly expensive professional operations bringing crime, you know, so if you take the riots, you're up against a highly professional operation, and most people aren't used to managing or interacting with that kind of crime. So,
in the United States, absolutely not. Yeah. Right. People that have lived in Mexico for a long time, for example, are very, in some other places. Yeah. Right. But it's worth talking to people that have lived in those types of situations to sort of know what that's like.
Mm-hmm. Right. And it's funny because it's when you can depend on the rule of law, you don't begin to appreciate the importance of community the way you do when you can't depend on the rule of law. So if you come to Solari, one of the questions, one of the taglines at the top of the website is, who's your sheriff? So and for years, I had people say, why should I care who my sheriff is? And now they understand. They really need to care about who their sheriff is. Mm-hmm. And if possible, they need to be talking to him. So.
Well, in the U.S., I think that's much easier said than done in rural communities than urban areas. But, you know, in the U.S. in particular, even though we talked about, you know, these efforts down the line with climate change to force people off rural territory, I think the communities, just based on my experience in the U.S., like I grew up in the South, a lot of those rural communities and like Appalachia and stuff are going to do pretty okay, I think, with a lot of stuff that's happened, because there is a lot of community interaction with law enforcement. It's not contentious. You know, people know the sheriff, and the sheriff stands up for the local community, not in every rural community, obviously, because there is corruption and things like that everywhere, regardless of size of the district or its the money that runs through it and whatnot. But it definitely, you know, there are communities that right. are still like that in the U.S. And I think they'll be better off than, you know, the metropolises of the U.S., certainly.
So one other thing I would say, I at various times I've sat down with both kids I help or the children of clients and worked through with them their investment in college or university education. And one of the things I've discovered is if you look at what they need to be successful in this world, a lot of times it's certainly not by going to a four-year program that specializes them into a corporate slot. The last thing you need to do is take on debt or spend a huge amount of money to get an education that really doesn't teach you very much other than slot you into a place you don't want to go. So I think it makes tremendous sense not just to homeschool in this environment, but to help young people develop skill after skill after skill after skill. You know, I always think of it as a toolbox and putting tools in your toolbox. So if you can know how to make an audio and video, if you can know how to be a chef, if you can know how to do a garden, if you can know how to drive a car, if you can know how to fly a plane, you know, all these different skills, when I said invest in yourself, the more skills you have, the better off you are. And that's because we're in an environment where if you can generate an income from doing five different things, you know, maybe two of those things will be good this year, but not next year. And you can do two of those other yeah. things the next year. So don't think in terms of, oh, I'm going to be a chef. Think in terms of, well, I could be a chef. I could be a bartender. I could be a doctor. I could be, you know, have the ability to have a portfolio of skills and be prepared to use all those skills to sort of build the pathway you want in this life, but to live a life where you're free. Because yeah. money in this environment is hugely overrated compared to freedom. And it's having multiple skills and multiple income sources that will make you free and investing in yourself and your own skills. So, you know, I think if you look at how you're doing it, it looks to me like you've got the, you know, you've got the notion of how this should work. And the reality is we're in an environment where things are very uncertain. So you try stuff, some work, some mm-hmm. don't. You try something else. You've got to keep moving forward. Right. So, okay, well, Whitney, this has been a great discussion. Anything else you're working on in terms of writing or focus now on the book?
Well, I'm going to be moving towards focusing on the book, but I don't totally want to abandon other content I do about right. things that are going on. But people with my work are probably familiar with the fact that I tend to do very long, detailed written investigations. Right. Those are very time consuming. So I really need to devote a lot of my efforts in writing to the book now, more full time. So what I'll probably be doing then is moving more towards sort of like audio visual content, maybe play YouTuber for a couple months or so. But I still do want to do some writing, but they'll mostly probably be the same style investigation I do now, but collaborative with a couple different people. So the burden isn't so much for those pieces. So some of the one piece I have in the pipeline in that sense is about this effort in the UK, the NHS, to remake it as NHSX, which is essentially,
what's that?
Well, that is the vehicle for the digital transformation of the National Health Service of the United Kingdom. So a lot of the talking points early on in COVID-19 in the UK where, oh, you have to do this to protect the NHS. It's a very well-regarded right. and well-respected and cherished institution in the UK. And that was sort of used to get people to rally around, you know, the COVID protocols and the lockdowns and whatnot. But of course, all of this has been used by the UK government to facilitate this digital transformation that will create a new system that doesn't even resemble the current NHS at all. That's completely telemedicine app based and all of this stuff. They've had it mapped out for quite some time. And a lot of the companies involved have ties to the intelligence services of either Israel right. or the United States, like Palantir being very involved in a lot of Israeli tech companies founded by former military intelligence people, either in terms of data management, AI, or healthcare, all being very involved in this, and essentially, you know, making the NHS a giant data harvesting operation for people. Right. And I think this may be helpful in getting some people in the UK that haven't really, that may have disagreed with analysis about COVID-19 last year, that some people were making and all of this stuff and challenging the policies that maybe believed the narrative last year, to show to them that they're is something nefarious going on, regardless of what you think about the realities of the COVID-19 crisis, or, you know, regardless of how you feel about that, this is something they're obviously doing that will have major implications. So I think that piece is important to get out, at least in terms of having an impact where I live locally now, and hoping that can have some sort of impact. But, you know, obviously I'm going to be focusing on Epstein stuff. So I'll probably have a couple, you know, articles based on some things I write about in there, specifically maybe historical stuff about, you know, intelligence and organized crime, how they first formally teamed up in World War II and Operation Underworld,
right,
things like that. You know, I may have some shorter articles about that stuff, but.
But you just have to promise me while you're doing all of that on Fridays, you're going to use cash, right?
Well, I use as much cash as possible anyway. though it's been a little confusing because I made the mistake of not cleaning my wallet out of Chilean pesos. And the coins look very similar to the coins used for British pounds and pence. So sometimes I like hand the person a Chilean coin
and they
stare at me. And I'm like, oh, but they look really similar. So it's confusing. I will use it on Fridays as well.
Okay, great.
Because I just tend to use it a lot.
Okay, so tell everybody how to find your website and follow up and support your work.
Okay, so my website is unlimitedhangout.com. So you can find my work there. I also contribute to thelastamericanvagabond.com. And if right. you go to their website, there's a section that's devoted to my work. But other people like Derek Bros, who does good work, and of course, Ryan Christian, yeah. who runs the site, do good work as well.
They do great
but,
work.
On Unlimited Hangout, if you're interested in supporting, you can just go to the Support Us tab and find information there. Or you can subscribe. If you subscribe through there, you can get access to any sort of paywalled content, but paywalled right. content isn't permanently paywalled. It's just for the first couple days. So it's sort of like an early access paywall
right.
for just some stuff, not everything.
Right.
And because it's mainly for people that want to support, not, you know, to keep my content to
now when the
people only.
When the book is available for pre-order, how do we find out? Do you have an email notification? Or?
It is available for pre-order.
Now?
So the publisher made it available on Amazon. The title of the book is One Nation Under Blackmail. So you can find it that way. But hopefully Amazon doesn't delist it. I don't know. Depends on how controversial the topic
right.
is or interest in the book is. It remains to be seen. The publisher is Trine Day. I think you can also
Chris
through, yeah
oh
yeah,
great
I think you can. Well, I mean, what other publishers are going to help me with a book like this? There's not many. You know, after
Chris Milligan is fabulous. I love Trine
yeah
Day.
He's a nice yeah. guy, so yeah. I appreciate that. So you can pre-order my book those ways if you wish. It'll be out early next year. One of the reasons it was supposed to be out at the end of this year, but there was a slight delay because I'm going to be having my second child at the
Whee!
End of the year. Yeah. so obviously I have to take that into consideration because, you know, so you can't always control when they come and whatnot. So had
yeah.
to leave some wiggle room there for me. So so that's pretty much how you can support my stuff. Though, if you do go to my Twitter _ Whitney Webb, you can find my link tree in the bio link, and there
uh-huh.
you can find all the links to social media, Telegram channels, and things like that. If you're interested in following,
okay.
I also have a mailing list on my website, which is probably a good way to go.
Okay.
As well. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Whitney Webb, you're doing great work. If we can help, just let us know. Okay.
Okay. Thank you. I appreciate it. Likewise.
Have a great day. Bye.
Okay. Thanks. Bye-bye.